Hello, this is Robert Kiyosaki. I'm in the studio with my dear friend Keith Cunningham, and we're going to be doing this brief tape of an overview of a very important subject called how to raise capital. And that's a question people ask me, how do you do it, or what do I need to do, or what do I need to study? And we won't give you all the answers in this 45-minute to an hour tape, but I think you'll have some good ideas of an overview of what it takes, how to raise capital, because so many times people come up to me and they said, you know, I don't have any money to invest, what can I do? Or doesn't it take money to make money and all this? In reality, as a friend of both Keith and I, we've done a lot of business with, he always says that only lazy people use their own money. And what that means here is that many times the small investor can't invest because, number one, they're trying to use their own money, and number two, they don't know how to raise capital. So it's a very important subject. I think you'll get a brief overview of what it might take. So if I can give you a little bit of my background before I bring Keith in on this tape is... When I started my first company in 1997, I went out and raised capital. And unfortunately or fortunately, I found that I had a pretty good talent at it, and I raised about $1 million. And the reason I say it's unfortunate is because in many ways I had no business raising that capital. And the reason for that was I raised capital on a business that was poorly managed. We had explosive growth. But the three young men that started the company in the late 70s, the company went up with that money really high, were very successful, and came crashing down. The investors lost their money. When I went back to see my rich dad after the dust had settled and the business had crashed, I mean, he closed the door in his office. The secretaries knew I was going to get a chewing out of my life. And rich dad then proceeded to scream with expletives and calling me all kinds of names and told me I had no business raising capital for a business that was not destined for success. In other words, I had the ability to raise capital, but I did not have the ability to run an international company. And that was my very painful lesson. And he slammed the door in 1980 on me, and he said, you know, that until you know how to run a business, don't raise capital, period. He says, when you're able to run a business and you don't need to borrow money, then you come back and see me. In other words, if a company cannot grow on its own, in other words, it's not self-sufficient, you really should not raise capital for it, what he was saying to me. He said, too many people borrow money thinking that money would solve the problems, but they really have no business borrowing that money. Ironically, the thing I did not know was that the ability to raise capital is a kind of an art as well as a science. Not too many people can do it. A friend of ours that both Keith and I know says that he's only had one or two partners in his lifetime that could ever raise money. It's a very tenuous subject. And so it took me until I was able to build companies again and run them successfully without having to have much debt, which comes from bank financing or equity financing when you go to private investors and they buy a piece of your company. Until I was certain of my ability to not only run a company or to invest in real estate safely, whereas a good manager has fiduciary responsibility to protect that money, I never went out and raised money again. So it took me about 15 years to build my self-confidence up. In other words, be a good business operator first before I went and raised money again. Because, like I said, I was successful at raising money, but unfortunately, maybe I shouldn't have been. And I lost millions of dollars for some of my friends and investors, and it's something that still haunts me today. And maybe it's good that it haunts me because they understood how speculative the investment was, so they understood they lost their money. I paid some of them back. But it really, that pain really made me a better business operator because it hurt me so bad to be so bad as a business operator, as successful as raising capital. So I've raised millions of dollars. I've gone back out and raised money again. My little companies now are very successful with or without capital. They do very well. They're self-sufficient. They grow. But today, I think it's very important that you know how to raise capital as well as how to run a business. What we're going to be talking about with Keith today is some of the things other than the technical skills of how you raise capital. So while I've raised millions of dollars, Keith has had the experience of raising billions of dollars. So I've raised millions, Keith has raised billions. So Keith, would you mind giving a little bit of your background in raising capital?
Thanks, Robert. My background is that I went to graduate school at the University of Texas. I got an MBA, and I was very fortunate to get involved very early in my career. In fact, right out of college, I got involved with two people who, in my mind, are mentors to me, and they were in the cable television business. And the cable television business is a very capital-intensive business, and my capacity with that company, I raised and helped raise several hundred million dollars Shortly after that, in the early 1980s, I got involved in the real estate business, and real estate is also very capital intensive, so my skills at raising money were again called on for the company that I had started to buy real estate in Texas in the early 1980s. And of course, anybody who is familiar with history, especially real estate history, knows what happened in the mid-1980s. You know, the bottom fell out of the market, and you know, everybody that was in real estate lost a lot of money. In fact, there's a poem that goes, "Money talks, I can't deny. I heard it once, it said goodbye." And that literally happened to me. So I made a lot of money, I lost a lot of money. But throughout all that, you know, I had raised a lot of money for my particular businesses and with my partners. For the last 10 years or so, I have been, in effect, a doctor for companies, helping companies that are in trouble figure out what the problems are and then get turned around. In addition to that, I've started several companies, including some car washes that we may wind up talking about here in a few minutes, a chain of car washes. In addition, several other industries that I've been involved with include healthcare. I already mentioned real estate and communications, cable TV, telecommunications. And this business of raising money is, Robert is right, there is part science and part art. And I think the science part is actually smaller, a smaller piece to the process of raising money than the art part.
So every time I personally want to understand the art and science of raising capital, I go see Keith, because in my mind, Keith is the person who is the expert on how to raise capital. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience, you know, flying in on the Learjet and going to Wall Street and talking to the investment bankers and raising money, millions and millions and maybe $1 billion?
In the early 1980s, when I was still involved in the cable television industry in an active way, there was a meeting that needed to happen in New York with some investors who were looking at investing. I think this particular deal was about a $90 or $100 million deal, and they were looking at putting capital in. There was a very crucial meeting that I needed to attend, and unfortunately I had all kinds of conflicts that were going to keep me from getting up to New York in an adequate amount of time. And one of my partners, who is still a great friend of mine today, was had a jet. And so he said, "Keith, just get on this jet, and that way you can almost be two places at once, and take this jet and fly it up to New York." And I had never done that before. Here I was about 29 or 30 years old, and you know, I had already raised a lot of money, but I had never been the only guy getting off a jet when it landed at Teterboro Airport in New York. So I get on the jet, it whisks me to New York, I get off the jet, I get on this red carpet that they roll out because it's a private airport, there's a limo there to pick me up, and which is all fairly overwhelming for anybody, but especially for a young guy, you know, who's still earning his stripes. And they whisk me into this meeting in New York, and one of the things that I found out in that particular process is that there is one of the pieces of the unknown is there is a big difference between being arrogant and being confident. And when I got off that jet, I got to tell you, my arrogance level was relatively high. As a matter of fact, looking back on it, I'm kind of probably am blushing right now, because even remembering the story, because I literally thought, you know, shoot, this is pretty snappy. Here's a guy 29, 30 years old who's, you know, the only guy getting off a jet, getting into a limo, being whisked down to Wall Street to have a meeting on a $100 million deal. And I got to tell you, it took probably a day or a day and a half for me to come back to the real world and realize that, you know, it's okay to be confident, but it isn't okay to be arrogant in the process of going about and raising money.
But also, that was part of what we're going to talk about is part of the genre or the air of raising money. I mean, confidence and arrogance and all that do go hand in hand, because people have a hard time giving money to somebody they don't have any confidence, or in risking their money with somebody they don't have any confidence in. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because Keith has other tape sets. One is called The Keys to the Vault, which is the more technical, as well as some of the art forms on how to raise capital. You can find that on our website called richdad.com for those who would like to have more information from Keith on how to raise capital. And what is the name of the other tapes that you have?
Success by Negotiation is another one.
And these are all technical skills as well as art form skills you need to raise capital. But what this tape is about is many people want to know how to do it. In other words, they want the technical knowledge of how you raise capital. But there's more to it than just technical. And that's what this overview on this tape is about. As an example, in the 1930s, the Carnegie Institute of Technology did this study, and they found out that financial success was only 15% of the equation. So many times people come to me and we'll show them a private placement memorandum, or we'll show them a business plan. They go, oh, is that all I need to do to raise money? So they roar out and they put together the right prospectus or private placement memorandum. They get the attorneys to bless it, or they put the right business plan together, which is the technical side, which is the 15%. They may have that, but they go out and then they try to raise capital, and everybody says no to them. And this is a little bit of why I've asked Keith to come together and give you some highlights, maybe the five most important things you think that are outside the technical side. For instance, rolling off a private jet from Texas, that's part of the genre. So when you talk to the Wall Street brokers and all this, there's a need for that confidence when you walk into the boardroom, because they hear the investment bankers of Wall Street see, you know, two or three guys like you every single day. And if you walk in and you don't have the air of confidence or arrogance, that's as big a part of raising capital as your business plan or your idea. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And somebody that Robert and I have both studied in the past is a man by the name of Buckminster Fuller. And one of the things Bucky talked about is that 99% of what happens is invisible. And to a large extent, I think the same thing is true with raising money, is that a huge percentage of what happens is the invisible part. So it's something other than the business plan. However, having said that, let me be quick to add that without the business plan, you're dead too. So it's not an either-or kind of situation to me. It's a both-and.
Keith and I were laughing this morning talking about, is it the way you dress? Is it the way you talk? And it's always different, because we were laughing about in the 1950s, you could have been this redneck, hayseed, Texas rancher, and you could have come walking into Wall Street saying, you know, I was just stomping around on my property out there and all the cow manure, and I was stomping away, and all of a sudden this black stuff got stuck all over my feet. I think it looks like oil. And you could be the biggest hayseed redneck. And back in the 1950s, if you were a farmer from West Texas, because that's where they were striking all the oil, and if you had cow manure and oil on your boots, they would have given you all the money in the world. That's the 1950s. Today you walk in like that, they throw you out. But today, as in the year 2000 and beyond, you walk in looking like a nerd. In other words, you look like an internet geek, you know, somebody who has no social graces. Your eyeballs are glued to a computer screen, but you can write great internet code. And you say, I have an idea. They'll throw billions at you. But the hayseed farmer. So it really has nothing to do with just technical or the way you dress or the way you look or your MBA and things like this. A lot has to do with what the market's looking for also in raising capital. So these are the factors that are kind of interesting in the subject. It's more, like I was saying, it's more than the business plan. It's more than pro forma. It's more than the written documents. It's more than the blessing from the accountant and the attorneys. And that's what we're going to cover today. So, Keith, what would you say that as part of the 99% you can't see, what else is important when raising capital outside the 15%?
I think one of the key things, Robert, that most people miss in the process of what it takes to raise money is that raising money is basically telling a story. And I think that some people have the ability to tell a story and to capture other people's imagination. And some people have a very hard time telling a story that will capture other people's imagination. In the tape set, Keys to the Vault, one of the things that I talk about is it how a lot of entrepreneurs fall in love with their product or their gizmo or their invention or their business plan.
Or their idea,
that's it. They fall in love with it and they think, well, this is such a snappy idea, it's going to be obvious to everyone that it's going to do very, very well, and there's no reason why people shouldn't not only throw money at me to help me get my company launched, but then once my company's launched, consumers are going to flock to the door and start snapping these my new invention off the shelf because it is the coolest. And so
what Keith is really saying here is this, is that the ability to tell a story, and I think that's one of the strong suits I had, because years ago I was studying what made great communicators successful, is that the great, like Churchill, Christ, Gandhi, Buddha, was they told stories. And so the same goes, I hate to say it, not to put religion and raising capital in the same vein, but the ability to tell a story is essential. And you must, like exactly as Keith says, you must capture the imagination of the people you're pitching the deal to. And while we're on this, Keith's tape set, Keys to the Vault, are priceless if you want to understand more of this, because it's a very brief set. But he goes into, there's different ways of raising capital. The first way most people go to is friends and family, and then you go to regular, you know, high-risk speculative investors, high-net-worth individuals. Then you can go to the stock market, or you can go to the private market for raise underwriters, things like this. So there's a whole different league of and sophistication that goes into telling the story, which again goes into the technical, why you need to have financial statements and numbers and projections and performance. Those are the technical part. But the technical part is enhanced by the story. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think when you look at the most obvious place that this happens is on Wall Street with public companies. The chief financial officer of a company, or actually even prior to the time that the company is public, when a company is trying to get public, they have something called a roadshow.
Also called the dog and pony show.
It's a dog and pony show. And what this looks like is that the senior management of the company that's trying to get public literally does a roadshow. They get on the road and might spend a month to 6 weeks having 5 to 6 meetings per day, every day, in different cities all over the country. And what they're attempting to do, the people they're talking to, are brokers.
Stockbrokers. Like.
Stockbrokers in these major brokerage houses like Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs. And so they're going around the country attempting to generate interest in their idea or their company or their invention or whatever it is they're doing. And so the better they do at capturing people's imagination in the process of raising that capital and trying to get public, the greater the first day pop. And we've all seen what's happened with some of these internet companies, you know, whose stock, you know, opens at 15 and the first trade is at 45 and it ends the day at $115 a share. And that is all about built up demand that's been generated as a result of somebody's ability to weave a great story and capture the buying public. In this case, you know, the people, if you're about to take your company public, then the people you're raising money from is the public. And so to the extent that you've told a good story and there's a lot of demand for your particular stock, then there's going to be a high jump on the first day of trading, and it's going to stay up. And so there's an enormous amount of emphasis in a public company on continuing the communication process with the brokerage community, and ultimately then with the buying, the investing public,
the shareholders,
so that what this will cause is people, the shareholders and the investing public, to continue to want to buy more and more of this stock because it's a good story. Now that leads to a second very crucial invisible thought, and the invisible thought is that if you're going to tell a good story, you also then have to perform and have credibility. I mean, it doesn't do any good to tell a great story and then not have the ability to come back around and perform in accordance with the story that you've just told.
And that's one of the big problems with the internet.com companies that are falling over right now, was that the story was so good. And it wasn't just the story of the people on the road show or the dog and pony show. Was the news, everybody was hearing about this instant.com billionaires and all this. So there was a story being told outside of you, the person trying to raise the capital. So the market was very ready for anybody coming around with some fly-by-night or solid.com company. The market was ready to buy anything. And the reason I know how hard it was is because one of my little oil companies, we struck oil. And here we are at good fundamentals. We're a profitable company. We have cash flow, but nobody's interested. All they want to know is, does it have oil.com after it and things like this? But during this mania, and I do call it a mania, people were throwing, you know, literally billions of dollars. If you just said .com, I have a 20-year-old kid who's an internet genius and he's a hacker on top of it, and Oh, great story. But you see, the story was not only your story, but the market story that they were listening to and what they were looking for. So a lot of times people are trying to raise capital, and they may have a good story, but the market's not interested in their story. They already have another story they're looking for. So that's a big aspect of raising capital.
No question. If you're in the process of raising money and you're looking for private money, and especially if you're going to go to a venture capital firm, venture capitalists tend to specialize in different aspects of the economy, or they specialize in different industries. And some of them have a specialization in healthcare, and others don't. And if you go to a venture capitalist who does not have a specialization in healthcare with a healthcare deal, you're not going to get very far because you haven't given him the product that he knows something about.
Yeah, they're already looking for a product.
There's no question. As a matter of fact, the statistics that I have, most recent statistics, are that last year there was about $35 billion invested by venture capitalists in the United States. $35 billion. In addition, there is another $36 billion sitting in their vault waiting to be invested. So there is plenty of money. What they don't have enough of is good deals, and part of what makes a good deal is the 15% that Robert has talked about that is the visible or the technical end of it, and the other 85% or 80% or whatever that number is that is the invisible part, and those two married together basically means that a venture capitalist will look at 150 deals to do one.
And there's a lot of money out there. That's when somebody says, I can't find money. The point I'm making here is this, is a lot of times the market's, it's not that the market's not buying your product. They're not buying you first. You haven't been able to tell them a great story. You don't have, you're not prepared for it. They don't have confidence in you. Or they're not looking for your widget that you're trying to bring to market. And those are some of the factors.
Well, there's one other part to that, Robert. I think it's a very important point. My theory has always been, in order to make $1 billion, really all you need to do is three things. You got to find out what they want, go and get it, and give it to them. And that's true not only from the standpoint of the business that you're in the process of trying to get funded. So, in other words, go to the marketplace, find out what they want, go and get it, and give it to them. It's also true from the standpoint of raising money. If what the market or the venture capitalist is looking for is a dot-com deal and you bring them an oil deal, then you're going to have a hard time getting funded. If the market is looking for internet and you're busy bringing them car washes, then it's going to be very difficult for you to get your company funded. The finding out what they want is not only finding out what the marketplace wants in terms of the buying, the consuming public, it's also what the financier wants.
That's a very good point, because I hear a lot of people come up and say, I have a great idea, or my business is very profitable, and I'm doing a good job with my company, and yet nobody's interested. Like I said, my little oil company is very profitable. In many ways, we really don't need the capital. We need the capital to drill more. But even though we're well-run, we did everything right, per se, the market still is not interested. So we have to now wait for the market to come around, which is, it is right now, because oil prices are sky high. And again, then the buying public is now interested in oil again. So that's part of the genre or part of the magic to raising capital beyond the 15%.
I couldn't agree more. Most entrepreneurs make the, in my opinion, fatal mistake of falling in love with the invention or the product. And I think if you listen to the tape series that I have called Keys to the Vault, I go into this in an enormous amount of detail. And in summary, the issue is this. It would be impossible for you to name a restaurant that makes more money than McDonald's. McDonald's, as a company, selling hamburgers, makes more money than any other restaurant in the world. And yet, given a choice of where I want to eat with you today for lunch, Robert, I'm not going to pick McDonald's. And I didn't pick it yesterday, and I won't pick it today. Now, that didn't have anything to do with McDonald's. It just has to do with there's other food that I'd rather eat. As a matter of fact, there's other food that most of us would rather eat, and yet McDonald's makes more money than anybody else. It's not about the product.
And what I say to people all the time, especially the guys in restaurants, they come up to me and says, you know, I want to have the best food and the best product and the, you know, best service and the best location and a white tablecloth. And I keep trying to remind them that the companies that make the most money don't produce the best food. And I think that's one of the things that's really hard for people to understand. They, as Keith is saying, they get so excited about that they're the best, we're number one, but the market doesn't really care most of the time. They want to find out how much money you can make for them.
That's exactly right. And it doesn't matter whether it's in the restaurant business. I mean, take a look at the computer business, which everybody's all excited about. I'm not a computer genius. I'm basically still in learning mode. But my friends who really are good at computers have said for years that the Apple Macintosh system is superior to the Microsoft Windows system. And yet Microsoft is worth, you know, 100 times or 200 times or 1,000 times, I don't know what the number is, but it's multiples more than Apple. It's, you know, the same thing is true with watches. I mean, most people I know would tell you that a Rolex is probably a better watch than a Timex. But, you know, Timex and Swatch watches and those kind of guys that make Casio, you make $40 watches, they make a whole lot more money than Rolex does. GM makes a whole lot more money than Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce builds a great product, but they don't make nearly as much money. So one of the things that the investing world is going to be looking for is not whether or not you're in love with your product. That's a foregone conclusion because most entrepreneurs are in love with their product.
I think it's one of the biggest mistakes I think poor people make is they think, you know, if you build a better mousetrap, that is complete hogwash. That is complete hogwash. Nobody cares. They want to know how much money your mousetrap can make to them, even if it's a lousy mousetrap. And is the market looking for a new mousetrap is the next question they're going to ask. And we're quite happy with this old one.
That's right. That's right. And so it's not only a matter of what is your idea, but in terms of raising money, but can the idea be turned into a profitable idea? And that profit could either take place as a result of, you know, an exit at some point. In other words, the company goes public or gets bought by
a major corporation
like Intel, who decides they like your new mousetrap, and so they decide to make
it. Or Time Warner, that wonderful company.
Yeah.
I love that company.
So there's all kinds of ways that people can make money. But at the end of the day, the venture world doesn't really care whether or not your restaurant is going to serve the finest foie gras or filet mignon. What they want to know is, do you have the business skills, which is what Robert was talking about earlier in some of his earlier experiences? Do you have the business skills, which means marketing, it means finance, it means accounting, it means management,
human resource development,
it's
accounting, tax law, there's so much to it.
A myriad of issues, and the question has to be, all right, well, can you take this idea and turn it into cash flow, a profitable business that can grow, or are you simply going to have the best filet mignon in the state of Texas?
And the same thing goes with real estate. A lot of people come up to me and they go, you know, I found this good piece of real estate, or I found a good investment, but I can't find an investor. And that's where, again, it goes back to the fundamentals, like we're talking about. You have to understand the numbers at this point. Write down a financial statement, show the numbers of the project you're doing it. And I had this one guy come to me from New York, and I said, I have this great investment deal. He wants me to put in $150,000 of a small apartment house and all this. But at the end of the day, there was no cash flow. I mean, there was no profit in it. I said, so why am I putting $150,000 in? He says, well, so when I read the numbers, because I could read them, he had an 80% management fee in there. I said, what is this expense here, management fee? He said, well, that goes to me. In other words, there was some cash flow, but he wanted me to put the money up so the cash flowed into his pocket. And I read this thing, I'm going, look, sweetheart, when you show an investor a projection on, let's say, this apartment house, was only like a $600,000 apartment house, you got to show the investor where the investor's going to make some money. Why am I giving you $150,000? We own 50-50, but you get 95% of the deal flow, the money flow. And he goes, what do you mean? Isn't that a good deal? I'm going, no. And that's where the numbers are part of the story. And if you don't, you're not able to read those numbers, hidden all those expenses is where a lot of times the guy presenting the deal is going to make a lot of money. And that's why financial literacy goes back to the basic skills again. You have to be able to read the deal.
I agree. In addition to the issues or the invisible things of confidence versus arrogance and being able to exude credibility, being able to tell a good story and be a good storyteller and capture other people's imagination, I think one of the other things that is part of the 85% invisible is really a two-part thing. It's kind of the ability to listen and the ability to read people. And then part two is the ability to be flexible. A lot of times people go in with a pitch to the investor and investment world, to either investment bankers or if you're going public or to the venture capitalist. And they've got it in their mind. This is what the story looks like, and this is the kind of deal that I want to get done. And they get so wrapped up in their own story and their own, in effect, box that they've created on what the deal needs to look like, that they miss some very, very valuable input. Most investors that I know are very, very bright people, and they are in the business of taking risk.
Well, if they have money, they did something right.
That's exactly right.
If they have extra money to invest, they're not dummies.
That's exactly right.
And oftentimes, if you're coming in as the dummy, presenting to somebody who has cash, and you expect them to be as dumb as you, they're going to just shoot you down because they can see you coming a mile away.
That's exactly right. So in the process of making the pitch and telling this great story, one of the keys, I think, is the ability to read what's going on across the table from you and what facial expressions or what body language the person across the table is using, so that you can then, as the story is unwinding or unfolding, you have the ability to move it in a certain direction. And if you find out that you're in the process of putting them to sleep, or if you say something and a huge frown comes on their face, most important thing to do at that point is to stop and say, okay, what are you thinking? I mean, give me some feedback here. And once you start getting their feedback, keep in mind that the investment world is, A, they're used to taking risk, and their whole goal is to find the hole in your deal. In other words, every deal's got places where it's weak, just like all human beings have some things that they're good at, and they have other things they're not so good at. And all deals have some place where there is a problem. One of the most important things you can do when you start hearing what that problem is be able to acknowledge that there is a problem, as opposed to being arrogant, and this is where the arrogance part comes in, as opposed to being arrogant and saying, oh, no, that's not a problem. I've had people pitch me a deal before, one specifically, and they've said, I said, well, who's your competition? And they've said, oh, we don't have any competition. I said, you know what? This meeting is over. I got no more interest. Everybody has got competition. That may not be direct competition, but everybody is competing for something. And it could be what you're competing for is people's disposable income. I remember in the cable television business back in the early 1980s, actually early 1970s, people came to us all the time and said, you know, you're the only game in town. You have no competition. I said, that's not true. We're competing with magazines and newspapers and bowling alleys. We're competing for people's discretionary income.
Free time, too.
Free time. So there's always competition, and one of the things that you have to be able to do in the process of telling the story is read what's going on across the table from you and make sure that you take their input. So what you're attempting to do is to have the financier, the people with the money, become part of the process and helping you so they feel like they're doing more than simply throwing, you know, $100,000 or $100 million at you and saying good luck and patting you on the back. They have to be a part of the process. And being part of the process means that they're going to have some input. They are smart people, and whatever idea, and it's not to say every idea that they have is right, but there has to be a willingness on your part, as the person attempting to raise the money, there has to be a willingness on your part to at least acknowledge that they have brought up a good point, and you may have a counter to that point to help show them, all right, well, here's why that isn't that big an issue. And that's really where the flexibility part comes in, is that sometimes there needs to be a plan B or a plan C, so that when they raise the point, all right, well, what happens if you don't get Lucent Technologies as a customer? All right, well, good. If Lucent ain't going to be our customer, maybe Intel will.
I think what Keith is saying here, Keith has, like I said, he's raised billions and I've raised millions. And so I come from the smaller investor level. What Keith is saying here is do not be afraid to pitch the deal, number one. But you've got to have some technical skills like cash flow analysis, you've got to get numbers together and all this. But the way you learn to be a good capital raiser is the guy, the investor sitting across from you, will give you feedback. And I've had people argue with me. and instead of learn from me. I had this one guy who says, what's a good idea? You're going to make a lot of money. I said, show me. No, no, you don't know what you're talking about. And he says, I'll show you when you give me the money. And so what Keith is talking about are billion-dollar companies and $100 million deals. It starts with even trying to raise $25,000. What Keith is saying to you here is don't be afraid of it. Go out there. They're going to knock you back. But if you're willing to listen and learn and take correction, the next time you pitch the deal to the next guy, you'll be a little bit better off. You'd be surprised how many times I've had people argue with me. And the reason I know that was when I was in my 20s, I argued with my rich dad, and he threw me out of his office. He says, I'm here to teach you, not to argue with you. And today, I have still these idiots come up to me. I have this great idea. I said, you and everybody else on planet Earth has a great idea. Well, you know, you should listen to me. And right away, they start arguing. And at that point, there'll never be a good money raiser. That's what Keith is trying to say to you, is that an investor with money has done something right, because 95% of the people don't have any money to invest. So if these 5% have money to invest, they've done something right. They have concerns. They would like to invest. They would like to find a great deal. They'd like to find the next Bill Gates or Microsoft or Michael Dell. They'd love to find you if you're that guy or woman. But if you argue with them, you fail to learn. So the thing that I recommend for people is this. Go find a small piece of real estate, or go find a laundromat you want to buy. Put together the numbers. Go to your family and friends and pitch the deal. But don't argue. They're going to give you their concerns. Each time they give you their concerns, or they point out the holes in the presentation or the flaw in this, you're getting smarter. But if you argue with them, you're getting more stupid, more arrogant, falling behind, and you'll never raise money that way. So if you're just starting out, I used to just practice on small deals. My first deal was a little laundromat when I was in college, actually. And I went out and I pitched a deal to my rich dad, and he ripped it to shreds, pointed out all the stupid things I wasn't doing and hadn't done, and things I had not looked at, and questions I should have asked, called due diligence is what he was saying. That was a technical term of it. I had not done my due diligence on the market. Just because it looked like my little laundromat would make money didn't mean it was a good deal. And the biggest thing he pointed out to me was, where was his profit? In other words, it would make me money, but it made him no money. And all these things are how we learn. We learn by making mistakes. And if we could start wrapping this whole thing up, that's how you learn. We practice. Keith and I have raised millions. He's made billions. I've raised millions. I've lost some of that money.
I've lost some of that money.
And it's painful. You have to go back to that guy or woman that trusted you and you say, I apologize. I screwed up. This is what I learned and all this. And most of them have said, call me back when I get the next deal. Because they're people who are sophisticated enough. You know, don't ask somebody who's starving to death, you're betting lunch money or the family's rent money. Never do that. But each time you get smarter, you get more humble in many ways, more grateful that somebody trusted you with the money. It's a very good process if you're willing to learn, if you're willing to be humble enough to learn. And it's a very good way to also become a better business person in the long run, because the more mistakes you make, I mean, like I said, the biggest mistake was I was successful the first time. And it was so painful that I raised money when I really should not have raised anything, because first of all, I was not a good businessman at the time. I was just starting out. But that humility and the meaning of that pain made me then a very good business person, and then I became a very good fund money capital raiser after that. But they go hand in hand. There has to be some legitimate economic basis for raising the money. So if you're going to raise money for a duplex, you're not going to raise $5 million for a duplex because it doesn't deserve that much money. But you could go and practice and raise $10,000 for a duplex. And you can pitch the deal, practice with your friends, ask them for feedback, and that's how you learn. Would you agree with that one?
Absolutely. In fact, I think you've made the point of really the last thought that I had on the invisible part, which is trust. At the end of the day, what people are doing when you go to them and ask them for money and they agree to give you money, at the end of the day, there is a trust factor that comes into play. And I've given some thought as to how you go about quantifying that, and I don't have a good answer for that. But I do know that you and I and everybody who's listening to this tape have had an opportunity at some point in their life to meet somebody and then kind of walk away from that saying, you know, I'm not really sure that I trust this person, and it doesn't have anything to do with
Good the deal is,
anything
or the numbers.
That really happened. It may not be the deal. I mean, you just kind of walk away and say, I don't know, this feels a little greasy to me. And so from my point of view, the other invisible thing that can happen out there is trust. And what we've been talking about is the 85% that is the invisible part that doesn't have a lot to do with the technical skills. The technical skills, I think one of the best ways you can learn about finance and financial literacy and those kinds of things is with the game that Robert has called Cash Flow. And I think it's one of the most powerful tools that I've ever seen to teach people the fundamentals, not necessarily of raising money, but the fundamentals of financial literacy and
financial statement.
And without the fundamentals of and financial literacy, all this business of raising money is so many angels dancing on a head of a pin. Because the reality is, without the financial literacy, without those fundamentals, which I think again are taught in the game that of cash flow that Robert has, I think without those fundamentals, this business of trying to raise money is, in effect, a lost cause, because you can't go to somebody and ask them for money and not have the fundamentals and the tools that I think are necessary.
If I could just pass this on, most of you heard me say it many times before, is that when I was having trouble in high school because I had bad grades, my rich dad put it all in perspective. He said to me very clearly, he says, my banker has never asked me for my report card. My banker only asked me for my financial statements. And that's what bankers look for, financial statements. What the game Cash Flow is about is your financial statement, how one works and all this. When I look at a piece of real estate, there's a financial statement I look at. When I look at a company, there's a financial statement in there. When I look at a prospectus on a company that might be started, I look at its financial statement. When I look at an existing company, I look at its financial statement. Those are the basis. It's the principles. That's why I created Cash Flow, and that's where it begins, because if you're going to ask somebody for money who has money, they understand a financial statement. And that's where the conversation begins as to what the heck, whether it's projected or actual, you know, whether it's, you know, it's the optimism for the business in the future. They still want to see the projected financials. And if it's existing, they want to see the existing financials. You can tell the whole history of the individual, the piece of real estate, or the business by looking at the financials. And so that's why my rich dad stressed financial literacy. He was, and you know what? He was tough on both Mike and I. He was honest. I'm still not good at it. Keith knows I'm not good at it, but I have respect for it. I have respect for people who can read it well. That's why I have my accountant always sitting beside me answering the questions I cannot ask, because a sophisticated investor, i.e. somebody with money who wants to invest, is going to ask you those questions anyway. And that's the 15% of the technical, and that's where it begins. That's why I created Cashflow 101. Yet I meet so many people come up to me and say, I have a great idea that's going to make you a lot of money, and all I want is $150,000 from you. I said, well, show me the financials. They go, I don't need that. Don't you trust me? I go, no. And that's where they stop, and then they get angry with me, and they call me a jerk and run out the door, and they look for somebody else. They probably pick on some widowed mother with three kids and promise them $1 million, and she kicks in the rent money and the food money, and then she has a problem because he's taking money from somebody who's not supposed to be lending you money. So this is where it all begins. It depends with the ability to get the 15% of the basic skills to understand that, go out there and practice on people who know what they're talking about. They'll give you the feedback you need to know to perfect, to correct, and get better and better at the game of raising capital. Because if you're going to be an entrepreneur, if you're going to be doing the bigger deals in real estate or be a bigger investor, as my rich dad said, he says, only lazy people use their own money. It's always OPM, other people's money, or other people's time. And those are some of the biggest leverages you can use. If you don't have those skills, then it's your time and your money, and most of us don't have enough time or have enough money to get rich. So thank you, Keith, for being a part of this tape. I'm really glad to be working with you again. For those of you, you can go to the website, richdad.com, and look for Keith's two tape sets. One's Keys to the Vault, and the other part is a very important skill set is ability to negotiate, because you must go to and fro. Nobody's going to just hand over the money. They're going to have their objections, and if you say you're an idiot for having this objection, you won't get the money and things like this. So negotiation is a very vital communication skill, which is fundamental to raising capital. So go to the website, take a look at Keith's products there, and you may, if you want to go further on it, order them and keep on with your education. So thank you, Keith.
Thank you, Robert.